Hello? Okay. Let's get started, everyone. So, hi. My name's Elliot Byrne. I'm actually the replacement moderator. Danny came in, was scheduled to do this. He called back, got called back to the office for an emergency loss reserve review, which is really true. So basically, my function here is introduce these two great speakers. And, I think this is going to be a great topic. I was very interested in this topic. If you were at the general session yesterday, they talked about the importance of rate monitoring and how reliable are the rate monitors that we're seeing and the rate history we're seeing. And, just from personal experience, just in the last few years, I mean, I've gotten a rate monitor from one client they went and asked their underwriters anecdotally what were the rate changes in the last 4 years, and that's, you sort of get a sample points of their underwriters, and that was what they provided. Another client sent their 8-year history of loss cost multipliers by state, and when they changed their loss cost multipliers, not really understanding that also needed the underlying ISO and NCCI rate loss cost changes to really do anything with it. So that's not the example we're going to have today. I think we have from a primary company, a company that has a pretty sophisticated rate monitoring system, and he's going to go through it. So let me introduce the speakers and get them started. First one is Larry Schober. He comes to us from Aegis, which is a high excess property and casualty insurer serving the utility industry. More specifically, the electric and gas utility industry. Larry writes that at an early age, he stood in front of a light switch and counted the number of times he can turn the lights on and off. And that's why he's in the actuary for the utility industry. I heard from his boss, he really stole that story from his son. So he is the pricing actuary for the largest industry-owned captive insurance company, Aegis. He has a bachelor's degree from New York University, is an associate of the Casualty Actuarial Society, and he didn't write it, but he must be a member of the American Academy. He's going to go first. Before he does, I'll introduce the second speaker so they can just tag team pretty quickly. Steve Petlick. Steve currently heads up the actuarial pricing function for casualty business for global and national clients within the Armonk hub at Swiss Re. Steve joined Swiss Re, formerly North American Re, in 1993 in the actuarial department. His initial responsibilities included rating system development and maintenance, as well as account pricing. He was the first at Swiss Re to be officially designated as a business unit actuary, and he moved to the global and national division in 1996. Steve began his career at Royal Insurance, where he held various positions in the actuarial and planning departments. He joined Continental Reinsurance in 1986 as chief actuary, and spent 7 years in that position prior to going to Swiss Re. Steve holds a Master of Science degree in operations research from Columbia University, and a Bachelor of Electrical Engineering from the City College of New York. He is a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society and a member of the American Academy. He's also involved in industry actuarial activities. And in case you didn't know it, he's also the president of Casualty Actuaries and Reinsurance, the sponsor of the meeting. So let me introduce first Larry Schober to talk about what they do at Aegis.
Oh, jeez. My name is Larry Schober. I'm the pricing actuary with Aegis. Today I'm going to be talking to you about price monitoring from the primary company perspective. It's going to be a tale of actuarial science in the streets. Again, it's a primary company. and I intend it to be a practical example providing some insights and lessons learned to encourage your primaries to price monitor. First, some housekeeping. The views expressed here are my own. They are not necessarily the views of the CAS, Aegis Care, the other panel participants. The talk today is going to have the following outline. I'm going to give a quick definition of what I mean by price monitoring. Our general approach to price monitoring, what we have, how we apply it and what we've gained from it. Some benefits that you get from price monitoring for a primary company. What's in it for the primary company to perform price monitoring? Some of the hurdles we encountered as we were doing price monitoring. Some quick observations on property as well, and finish off with some shortfalls and pitfalls that the primary company encounters while they do price monitoring. I'd like to make a quick sidestep here and talk about actually the failure to price monitor. And this observation was made looking back in the soft market in the 1990s. And I guess from this morning, when we were talking about the underwriting cycle, as we saw, it's not driven so much by losses as by the lack of premium growth. And price monitoring helps relieve that sort of lack of premium growth. And it's not the property casualty industry's greatest catastrophe wasn't from hurricanes, it wasn't from earthquakes or pollution. It was the failure to intelligently price monitor during the down market or soft market. And this observation is food for thought as we're in the throes of the underwriting cycle. To put the discussion in context, I want to tell you some things about the data that we were price monitoring. Aegis, Associated Electric and Gas Insurance Services, AEGIS, is the utility industry mutual for the electric and gas industry. We write a variety of coverages in liability and property. We write D&O, workers' comp, property, EPLI, of course, GL. It's high excess. The attachment points vary from 200,000 to 10 million, and the limits vary from 10 million to 35 million. So it's all over the map, and there's a lot of variability in what we're trying to monitor. It's a Bermuda company, so we're not admitted. There's no right filings or filings for rating plans, so we have a lot of flexibility as to the kinds of changes that we want to implement, which may not be the case for all primaries. What do I mean by price monitoring? It's hard to get, for the primary, as I'm sure it is for the reinsurer, to get underwriters to appreciate the difference between rate levels and premium levels, but the difference is crucial. By price monitoring, I mean you want to measure the changes in rate levels achieved from one period to the next, and this is more than just simply an individual premium change. Maybe an example would help. If you cut your auto, say, by half from one year to the next, your premium level will be halved. But if they use the current factors in your pricing program, your pricing will remain unchanged. The same is also true for term. If intuitively, if pricing should be unchanged, if, for example, your term is halved. But it's interesting to gauge the reaction of underwriters as you try and explain this to them, these subtle differences. I'd like to lead off first with our approach to price monitoring, getting started, and maybe some compelling conceptual displays that we use with our underwriters. So where do you begin price monitoring? Where do you start? Our process began over a decade ago, and the important thing to take away is that you've got to start. We began with our largest premium coverages. Again, we're the gas and electric utility industry. Mutual, we started with gas and electric. We're all utilities all the time. And this would give us the biggest and quickest payback for our initial efforts. We kept it simple. We started with domestic because it's the most standardized. This can be expanded to include, say, your foreign exposure. We found the act of monitoring actually aids in encouraging standardization. The more you actually monitor, the more discipline the underwriters miraculously are able to show. So this is encourages underwriting discipline, the act of monitoring. So beginning to monitor has its own own major virtues. And you could, of course, as your coding improves or as your business expands, you can expand that from your initial simple process. Starting to price monitor has the benefit of providing the opportunity to contribute to all of the underwriting programs at the outset. You know, it's when you introduce new rating, if you're performing the price monitoring as you introduce new rating plans and class systems, you can weigh in on the value of certain policy forms, endorsements, and exclusions. So once you start price monitoring, you actually are you're getting this collateral benefit that is a tremendous value to the primary company. It opens the door to just simply more than just making rates. We make rates for our coverages. We are not part of ISO or the National Council. So we're making our own rates, but it's more than just simply making rates and setting premium levels and walking away. These collateral contributions that you're making for the rating plans and to the class systems that are an outgrowth of a part of price monitoring are a big follow-on effect of starting to price monitor. What are some of the ways that the primary company would price monitor? I'm going to give you here a quick catalog of the various ways that price monitoring can be performed by the primary company. The simplest price monitor would be performed on aggregate data. The aggregate data, there's the basic assumption that when you combine all this together, that the basic exposures, the limits, and the retentions are remaining stable and homogeneous. And you're closely aligning whatever premium change that you see that I was discussing earlier with the rate change that you expect. This is the simplest type of price monitor that you can do. And again, it's on aggregate data. You're not looking at individual policies. The second level of price monitoring would require you to look at individual policy information. You're not looking at aggregate data. You're looking at individual policies. And here you're matching renewals with like terms, where you're pulling out the policies that share a common exposure, a common limit, and a common retention, and comparing those policies to see what kind of rate change you achieve. The only thing changing is the premium change. This, of course, because it's so restrictive, you're tossing out an awful lot of information. In fact, you're tossing out a lot of policies that you may not. So you're reducing your premium change to something that's quite smaller than your total premium volume. And you can expand that to include price change on renewal, again by policy, but you're restating for exposure changes. So you're allowing the exposures to change as well. If you restate your exposures, you're now bringing in even more policies into your analysis. But you're focusing again on renewal, and you're focusing on the same limits and retentions and allowing only a simple exposure adjustment to be performed. The next level would be to bring in all renewal policies. In order to do this, not only do you simply have to make an adjustment for your exposure changes, you've got to make some adjustment for your limit as well as for your retentions in order to make a comparison from one period to the next to see how your policies are actually changing. Your pricing is changing. The most complete price monitor would be for all policies. That is, you want to bring in all new, renewal. Again, this is on the, as well as, I guess, even lost business, because you're looking at business from the prior period that doesn't renew in the current period. This is the most sophisticated. This is the most difficult. It's the most complex. And this would actually require you to re-rate all of your individual policies for retention, changes in limit, changes in exposure, changes in coverage and endorsement. This is an extremely detailed analysis. As you go down this list, you can see there is increasing detail in the data records that you're looking at. There's increasing complexity as you actually perform this price monitor change. And there's also the benefit of increasing accuracy. What did we face when we were trying to decide what to price monitor? We're a mutual, we're the industry mutual, so we had a very high retention ratio. That is that we had a north of 95% retention ratio. So in looking at one year to the next, you would have very much the same policy in one period to the next period. it's a homogeneous book. It's all utilities all the time. So you would think that the simpler ones, the aggregate data or price change and renewal, would be a very attractive choice. One thing that we immediately encountered, though, was that the underlying industry, the utility industry, was in flux. The utility industry was going through a period of consolidation where the companies, of course, were buying one another, not dissimilar to what's happening in the insurance industry. They're going through periods of deregulation where the individual states and the federal government were stepping aside and letting them act in a very competitive fashion. And that, of course, had increased competition. Well, with the increased consolidation, there were changing exposures. As the companies were out there buying one another, all of a sudden your exposure was changing all over the map. With the increased competition, there was changing risk appetite, so there was changes in limits and retentions that we wanted to capture. The increased competition also fostered new business that we wanted to capture as well. That is that they had there were additional companies that were entering the marketplace that we wanted to isolate and see how we were pricing on new business. And then on top of this, we had an existing database that had some detailed information that we wanted to leverage into our new into our price monitor. And given all of these, initially, like I say, we would have picked the aggregate data would have been a initial reaction that we would have chosen. But due to the changing exposures, limits, and retentions, and the additional new business, our natural choice was to go for the more detailed information, all policies, new and renewal. And this would be a very complex process of re-rating the individual policies. One counterintuitive result that we found was that for the rate-making and reserving process, that is making all level factors and trying to estimate IBNR by layer, we were doing a lot of this detailed work anyway, that the easy price monitors to step out and do the aggregate data analysis of price change and renewal would actually be additional work. We were performing the analysis where we were re-rating the policies in the rate-making and reserving process. And so naturally, this was a huge benefit for us to be able to leverage that into our price monitor. When I say re-rating, what do I mean? Re-rating sets the standard or the benchmark for comparing what was collected. The benchmark standardizes what changes you have. The benchmark for us, since we don't file our rates, our benchmark are the rates that we generate. For most of the primary companies, it's going to be manual rates, the filed rates. Your benchmark rate standardized changes in for exposure or for retention limit and term, et cetera. What do I mean by when I say the index or ratio of actual to benchmark? What do I mean? This marks the performance of collected premium to the standard basis across all policies. In formal terms, for a given policy year, the index calculation, again, actual in the numerator of a benchmark, just the sum of your exposures at the time that they were written, the rate at the time they were written, the relativity at the time they were written, it's your actual premium at the time it was written in the numerator. Your benchmark is the repriced or recalculated premium according to your benchmark as opposed to what subjective modifiers might have been included in your actual premium. Once you have an index, or that is the ratio of actual to benchmark, and you recalculate this again for a period, a policy period, it could be for a quarter, or a policy year. We stick with policy year as our basic building block for rate making. Once you have an index, it's easy to calculate a change. Taking the ratio of indexes from one period to the next measures the change due to rates, merit rating factors, and market forces. You can isolate the impact of the rates. You can isolate the impact of rating factors once you're able to break this down by individual insured. One of the important things here is the ratio of indexes controls for changes in limits, retentions, as well as exposures. How do we address the issue of a wide variety of limits and retentions in the data that I had referred to earlier? We fit our losses to a log normal distribution to quantify the impact of changing limit or retention, a la the Michaelis paper with the ratio of limited expected values using the retention and the limit to isolate the layer or the subject premium layer that you're trying to analyze. Well, this requires you to refit the data or refit your loss distribution regularly. We refit every month. And this refitting, in turn, is a monitoring process that lets you monitor the underlying shifts in business for increased severity or changing severity. I'd mentioned before that there were compelling underwriting exhibits that we had that we were trying to show. One of them is this converting this index to an adequacy point. Now, I've not seen this done elsewhere before. And the adequacy point basically takes the index and tries to generate what is an adequate index. You can, if you're performing the price monitor as well as performing your rate review, you know what index or ratio of actual to manual generated an adequate premium. This latest index is typically taken from the recent rate review adjusted for your indicated deficiency or redundancy. To convert to an index point, or rather an adequacy point, you take your latest period reading for your index. Say the rate review generated 0.75 is your adequate ratio of actual to manual, and your current period has an index of 0.8. Well, 0.8 obviously is greater than 0.75, so your adequacy point is over 1. An index reading of 0.8 translates into an adequacy point of 1.07 or 0.8 over 0.75. I'm saying this is a compelling idea for underwriters. And most of the underwriters I know, the eyes start to glaze over at this point. It's not very, very effective. But one, I guess, a picture is worth 1,000 words. This is the typical document that we would be generating for our underwriters, where you can see the jagged red or the jagged points or the individual volatile monthly points. And we're smoothing those to those bars you see across the type. That would be the what you achieve for a given year. This exhibit displays two key concepts. The first one, obviously, is the step from one level to the next, how pricing is changing from one period to the next. The grid is annual. So you can obviously see here the underwriting cycle. The steps are the pricing changes. And the other key concept is this adequacy level on the right-hand side, or unity. If you see that unity bar, you can see not only, one, how the pricing is changing, but in addition, you can readily see how the adequacy of the premium dollar that they're collecting. So again, there are two key concepts here, the changes in pricing and the adequacy of your premium dollar. This is a very powerful exhibit when trying to discuss what's happening in underwriting with your price monitoring. One additional thing is the actual premium bars on the bottom lets you emphasize individual points or changes that you might actually be encountering. This is a visual display of changing adequacy and pricing, and it directly relates pricing changes to changing rate adequacy. And this substantially improves the dialogue with underwriting. Since the data is by contract, it contains all new, renewal, and lost business. So you can monitor new separate from renewal, separate from lost business. You can test all the hackneyed pricing assumptions. You can look and see, is your new business priced higher than renewal? Is your new business priced lower than renewal? What about new business? So if it has a higher or lower adequacy point, so what? Since you're now involved so deeply with underwriting, you can you probably participate in establishing any new underwriting guidelines, but check to see if there's any new underwriting guidelines. But also the important thing is that the position in the where we are in the underwriting cycle plays a significant role. In a hard market, you would anticipate that your new business should be more stronger priced than your renewal. If it's a soft market, you'd anticipate the opposite. That is, you'd expect to be new to be priced weaker than renewal. But if new is priced weaker than renewal, one of the immediate responses of the underwriters are they're picking out the better risks. They're successfully skimming the cream. And your response typically is that, oh, well, gee, they're buying new business. And this is a, what contribution can the price monitor make at this point? I'm going to go back to this later on. Okay, what benefits did we see in price monitoring? That is, what benefits were there from a primary company perspective? What's in it for me to do price monitoring? The obvious one is decision making. It helps you set targets. It helps you target pricing by account, especially with experience rating. So coupled with the price monitor, where you look at individual changes by account and experience rating of an individual account, it's a very powerful renewal tool. And the important part for the primary is to make the monitor part of their pricing culture, to incorporate it in all aspects of their pricing. It's good for price monitoring. It's good for industry comparisons. One of the things we were seeing earlier today was about the CIAB, the Council of Insurance Agents and Brokers. It produces a quarterly result that you can compare. The underwriters love to see how are we doing compared to the rest of the industry. They love to see this. The CIAB is OneSource, Advisen, Market Scout. Those, as I spoke to earlier, those are more akin to premium changes. They are not rate changes. I guess Tillinghast produces CLIPS, which is a more akin to rate changes, as we were describing. But they're useful, I guess, in the terms of the mood ring, are prices going up or prices going down, and how is your pricing performing relative to the industry? You can test indicated rate changes versus achieved rate changes. You send the troops out for 10%. What are they coming back with? The price monitor enables you to get a quantification of just how well the individual underwriters are performing. It helps with stratification. In particular, large versus small pricing by asset size. You can pull out, since it's by policy, you can look at your large asset pricing versus your small asset pricing. Are you giving away the large accounts? Are you hitting the small accounts harder? Similarly, low attachment versus high attachment pricing. Where is your where are your changes going? It's by policy, so you're actually able to pull out by policy these changes. One of the biggest benefits of price monitoring that I had alluded to before was the collateral contributions of actuarial to underwriting, and they're a big follow-on benefit of price monitoring. The simple act of price monitoring leads to underwriting discipline. This is one of the important aspects that we discovered, that the more they're being watched, the more discipline seems to appear. Once the underwriters see that you're all the cool stuff that you can do, they start asking for more information. They start to actually take ownership of this report. And this generates, in turn, more frequent contacts with underwriting, which, quite frankly, is a benefit to both parties. This generates, naturally, on-level factors for rate making. This is a natural byproduct of price monitoring. I mentioned before that we did it in reverse. We were doing the on-level factors and started price monitoring from there. But for the typical primary company, on-level factors for rate making is a tremendous benefit. It helps in reserving for the primary. It helps especially in trying to measure exposure to loss. Another benefit is that since the data is by contract, you can aggregate contracts for a given underwriter or underwriter team. And you can perform monitor pricing by underwriter or underwriting team. Now, this I'll come out straight out and say this is a source of contention with the individual underwriters. No one particularly enjoys drilling down to the root here. But once you have it by individual policy, you can actually monitor pricing by underwriter. One of the final benefits of the price monitoring, actually it's an outgrowth of your on-level factors that I wanted to mention, was that it's a useful back test of whatever your trend assumptions might happen to be. In the typical policy year exhibit, you might expect your actual loss ratios to have a distinct upward trend. That's policy year along the bottom, loss ratio along the side. If your on-level factors and your trend assumption that's built into your price monitor is correct, you would anticipate your on-level loss ratios to be relatively flat after your adjustment. If there's a residual trend in there, you haven't included enough trend in your process, or your trend is understated. If you've overcompensated and there's a downward trend in your on-level loss ratios versus your actual loss ratios, you've included too much trend in your the typical heavy-handed actuary. What were some of the hurdles that we faced that a primary company would typically face or expect? The biggest hurdle is also a great opportunity. You need the personnel and the personality to insert yourself in the underwriting process. But it also gives you a great opportunity to make real contributions to the underwriting process. The second hurdle is a great chance to raise the credibility and reliability of your monitor. And that is trying to foot to the financials. The problem here is that it complicates the process as well. The putting to the financials, accounting data is almost always on a policy level basis, whereas what you're trying to get to is a detailed coverage level suitable for re-rating. It's at a much more finer or granular level. We address this problem by rolling up the coverage level to the policy level, and the policy level is actually included in the financials. So the policy level is in the financials, but it's built from the individual coverage level. Price monitoring takes time. At least two or more years for some sort of comparison to be performed. The data quality, you're subject to the, you are totally beholden to your data quality. The more detailed the price monitor, the more reliant you are on the quality of the underlying data. And that requires the individual actuaries to perform data quality examinations and actually encourage the improvement of input by the underwriters. I mentioned earlier about new business. It takes time to perform this. If your new business is an existing line, then you have a comparable set of results. You can compare your new business to expiring. If for example, it's an investor-owned, for us, if it's an investor-owned utility that we're writing a new business, we have a book of investor-owned utilities. It's instantly comparable. We can get a very good feel on new business. If it's new business in a new line, that's a little more problematic. It's harder to compare. It's hard to compare if all of a sudden we saw personal lines coming through. It would be very hard for us to create any sort of comparison. Programming is not that we encountered is not for the faint of heart. These contracts are highly customized. Individual contracts, or rather the endorsements, have a lot of exceptions, and it creates a lot of complications. The detail of the data is down to the level of the coverage level, and this is where the primary is a distinct advantage over the reinsurer because they're a lot closer to the data. Changing systems, new rating plans, new underwriting systems, data feeds need to be consistent once you introduce new underwriting systems. We had a new underwriting system introduced, and trying to get the old data to talk to the new data is really a major, we found that to be a major issue. Just the takeaway here is that price monitoring is not once and done. Some quick observations on property. Most of what we've said here have been generalizations. These generalizations hold true for, at least for personal lines, lots of similar policies, little judgment. It's easier to price monitor. Commercial casualty, fewer policies, but more judgment. The more judgment there is, the harder it is to price monitor. In commercial property, you have even fewer policies. If you want to count layers as records, then that's an improvement. You get a few more records, but commercial property has the most judgment. And we found that the detail of data for our property was not as robust as it was for our casualty. Judgment makes property programming extremely difficult, but your data has to be able to carry that into the detailed price monitor. So property is more complicated, less standardized than casualty. So we ended up driving back to, in that scale of various price monitors, we ended up choosing pricing on renewal as opposed to re-rating individual policies. We re-rate to expiring. This is a constant problem in property. Do you pare back the renewal coverages so that it's similar to the original policy, or do you build up the old policy to the new? We chose to re-rate to expiring, adjusting for changes in exposure limit and layer. Again, we found that the property data, just because of its the unique characteristics, is just not as robust as the casualty data. We also found that what scale do the underwriters use? They shift scale back and forth. Are they shifting scale for pricing, or are they shifting scale because of true underlying differences? And this can be a real problem for trying to price monitor. But once you have the data by contract, you can produce really cool color graphs with, here it is, changes by band, where the upper green ones are increases, the lower red are policies that show decreases. The strongest exhibit or display is just simply a price change by monthly period, and we add to that a maximum and a minimum, saying, well, your central point close to unity is what your the change you want to monitor, and you can add a maximum and minimum. You can add 95th and 5th percentiles to see how that's changing. And these are, again, very compelling graphs for the primary underwriters. This would be this would be the prior policy to a year before. So that would be January to the prior January, to February to the prior February. And if you looked at the 95th percentile or the maximum, what was its maximum to the prior maximum? What was the minimum to the prior minimum? What are some of the shortfalls and pitfalls that that we encountered? The underwriters legitimately try to gauge exposure to loss, and we're stuck with whatever exposure base we have in our proxy, or rather in our benchmark proxy. The underwriters truly want to try and measure the loss. And we are stuck with whatever we have. One of the additional pitfalls is that any sort of inflation-sensitive exposures need adjustment. You've got to go back. If it's a dollar-denominated amount, then it needs to be changed. For autos, for the electric and gas industry, it's throughput kilowatt hours. That's not inflation-sensitive. But if you do have payroll or revenues, those are inflation-sensitive exposure basis in the adjustment. Endorsements and coverages change, and changes in coverage are particular speed bumps for a primary company. They have the data, they have the detail, but the drive to automate really, you start using a computer. Once you start using a computer, if you're doing it right, it really speeds things up. If you're doing it wrong, you can really foul things up. So that's a major pitfall for trying to automate the price monitor process. More of a pitfall than a shortfall is continuing to monitor during the soft market. You need commitment by senior management to continue to monitor even while prices are going down. Everyone loves to hear about prices as prices are going up. But I guess our job is to continue to monitor even though the soft market is taking over. The one piece of good news is that if you've monitored during the hard market, you've built up street credibility with the underwriters so that you can they're more willing to listen to the bad news of the declining prices. Finally, price monitoring quantifies. That's the big strength we have as an actuary, but it's a model. As a model, correcting the shortfalls of these models actually is a positive feedback loop for actuaries, where frequent review of trend, severity, coverage changes forces us to re-examine our assumptions and go back to underwriting and check with them. And this reinforces underwriter contact, which again is a positive benefit for everyone involved. So in conclusion, we found that price monitoring helps us to speak rationally to management, to our colleagues in underwriting, to our reinsurance partners. And so I'd like to take this on. Let's see now what reinsurers can do with the output of this process, or at least from the reinsurer's perspective.
Okay, we heard from Larry the perspective from a primary company, and I'm very glad that I was able to look at Larry's presentation before completing mine, because I'm not going to go over a lot of the basics and the definitions and pitfalls of the primary price monitor. I'm going to be looking at it from the standpoint of the reinsurance pricing actuary, and I'm going to be covering, again, from the perspective of the reinsurance actuary, the effect of new business. I'm going to talk about changes in quality of business, which is something that often comes up in this process, and sort of what do we do? What do we do at Swiss Re, and what can you do to overcome some of the issues that I'm going to refer to? What Larry outlined for the primary company is great. I mean, rate monitoring for a primary company is a very important metric in managing their business. There are a lot of uses for it in terms of incenting underwriters, looking at how they're performing versus the industry, a number of other things. But for us, the reinsurance pricing actuaries, I don't want to say that we don't care about those things, but those are not the primary focus of a rate monitor. What we're trying to do is we're trying to price this treaty. We're trying to evaluate the economics of the treaty. And one of the major variables in this process is being able to put premiums on level. What we do is we trend historical losses. We all know how to do that. It's hard to pick the trend factors, but once you have them, it's easy to trend. Put the historical premiums at the rate level of the prospective treaty period. That's what we're trying to do. And I think as those of you who've priced a lot of treaties and have been doing it for a while, you know very well that during hard markets, you can take some programs that look pretty ugly and make them look very, very good by superimposing 30, 40, 50% rate increases on them. And, of course, the opposite holds true. I think I made up this slide a few years ago when I was doing this, so I put the other thing first. But I think the last comment holds much more true right now, that you can look at programs that have very, very good loss ratios in 02, 03, 04, and then when you go through the reinsurance pricing process, their loss ratios just, they don't look anything like what they looked historically. And the mathematics of the trending and on leveling is what does it. Okay, let's get down to an example. Again, I'm not going to go over the different types of rate monitors. Larry has done that for you. You get a reinsurance submission. By the way, if anybody has questions, please jump in, interrupt me. I love this to be interactive. Love to hear what your questions are, what you have to say. You get a reinsurance submission, and this is a treaty that you've never priced before, so you don't really know much about how they monitor prices and how they do it. And, you know, Exhibit 4A or something looks like this. There are the rate changes, and you know they sort of make sense according to the cycle and what you think of the industry. Now, you know, maybe your knee-jerk reaction, maybe in the old days you would have said, hey, this is great. I'm going to pump this into my spreadsheet that does on-level factors, and I'm done with this. I can look at other things. But I would suggest that you don't do that. I think you have to stop and think about a few things. If I saw a rate monitor like that and I didn't know anything else, I would go back to the client with a number of questions concerning their rate monitor. Basics, are they written or earned? That's a pretty basic one. Are they adjusted for exposures? You would expect that they would be, but we've seen cases where they're not. They're just premium changes. Are they adjusted for changes in limits, attachments, SIRs? Larry spoke about that, the things you can do to adjust for that. Now, some of the big questions, do they include new business or are they measured on renewals only? I would suggest from my experience that the most common is renewals only, that new business has not been factored in. Do they include commission changes? That's another interesting one. I think from the standpoint of the primary company, that's important. I would suggest that for the reinsurer, maybe you don't care about that because your expense is going to be considered elsewhere when you look at the ceding commission. So that I've seen rate monitors where they do take this into account. Terms and conditions, that's a hot one for me. No one will deny that terms and conditions are extremely important as markets go from soft to hard. But we all know that how difficult it is to translate. Having a rate monitor is not really good enough. It's a lot better than what we had 10 years ago when a lot of companies didn't have those, but I think you've really got to take it a lot further, especially in this market as it is right now. Okay, I'm going to get into some examples, and I want to focus a little bit on the new business question. First, this is a real simple thing. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start out with the premise that we have a 2007 ultimate loss ratio. It's been developed, but not trended on level. And what we're going to do is we're going to use this to price a treaty for 2009, effective at 1/1/2009. So I'm using 2007. The reality is you're going to use 5 years, but I don't want to complicate this with a bunch of years. You're going to do the same thing for every year. So let's just focus on the 2007 now. Now, the simplistic thing is, okay, your trend factor is 6%, and your renewal rate changes are minus 10 for 2008 and minus 10 for 2009. So you're going to get two shots of minus 10 to hit that 60%, and of course the simple thing to do is this, to trend it for 2 years and put it on level for 2 years. And this is a little bit crude, but you wind up dramatically going from 60 to 83.2. And that's real, that can really happen. However, You haven't done anything about new business. You've taken the renewal rate change, and the company maybe told you, we don't really think our new business is priced any different than our renewal business, so why don't you just use that, and you've done that. So you get an 83.2. Now you worry about new business, and you say, well, what if the new business is less adequately priced than the renewal business? How is this going to affect your projection? Well, it's probably not going to affect it favorably. In order to answer this question, you need to know a couple of more things. One is the renewal retention rate of the company. If they're retaining all their business and it's all renewal business and not writing any new business, then it doesn't matter, but that's never the case. And also their projected premium growth. If they're growing a lot, that probably means they're writing new business. If they're shrinking a lot, maybe they're not writing that much new business. What I did is I set up a very simple simulation model to try to get a handle on this. It's really very, very very kind of crude, but I think it does illustrate. And you don't really need to do a simulation model for the new business effect, but I was trying to go the next step, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. I started out, I just made up a portfolio of 100 policies, and it came to about $50 million of premium. I simulated all of the beginning premiums on it, and I said the loss ratio is 60%. I said every policy has a loss ratio of 60%. That's not realistic. Maybe we'll think of that as the expected loss ratio. In reality, if you have a bunch of policies, most of them are going to have a zero loss ratio, and a few of them are going to have a pop. But just for the purpose of the exercise, let's call it the expected loss ratio. Okay, I also said the renewal rate changes of minus 10, as I had said before, and a renewal retention rate of 80%, which is kind of, that's kind of a rate that you see pretty frequently out there. I also assumed that new business for 2008 and 2009 will consist of 20 new policies with the same average premium as the renewal book. So no difference, it's the same kind of business, no difference in anything else, just simulated the premiums. But now, here's a key assumption. I postulated that the new business differential, and I'll talk about what the definition of that is in a second, values, I tried it with three different values, 0, minus 10, and minus 20. 0 just means that the renewal book has the same rate level as the renewal book, and minus 10 and minus 20 means something different. Now, we talk about new business renewal rate changes and new business rate changes. Let me just talk about this for a minute. I'm not really sure what we mean by a new business rate change. Is it relevant to us in terms of pricing our treaty to know that this piece of business we wrote is being written at 10% less premium than with the expiring carrier? I don't know that's the metric that we're really looking for, because we don't know how the prior carrier's rate levels compared to this particular client that we're rating. So that 10% drop may be a positive thing, or it may be even more than minus 10%. What I would suggest is that we try to measure the difference in rate level between the new business and the renewal business in our client's current portfolio. That to me will tell you how the new business is what impact it's having on your on level factor. So my definition is the difference between in rate adequacy between new business as compared to the renewal book of business, and not the rate change on new business. So now you're all probably thinking, well, what is it? How are you going to measure this? And Larry talked a little bit about ways to do this, but I'll get back to that. But I just want to go through the structure of the model that I did. So based on the 2007 year, the portfolio was simulated. Okay, the premium is generated, as I said. I did it from a uniform distribution with a loss ratio with a mean of 60 and standard deviation of 10. I don't know if that's realistic. It's probably realistic for some books of business. For others, it may not be. Then what I said is that now I went ahead and I said, okay, now I'm going to bring this book forward to 2008. So every policy of my 100 policies is either renewed or not renewed. Now, I know the renewal retention rate is 80%, so I just give each policy an 80% probability of being renewed, period. And if it is renewed, it gets the renewal rate change of minus 10%. It's renewed at 90% of its expiring premium, as per what the client has told us about the renewal rate change. So that's pretty straightforward. What I also did is I, in order to come up with a loss ratio for 2008, I trended the losses. I put a 6% trend on it, and of course apply the 10% rate change, you were going to get the effect that I talked about before, the 1.06 divided by 0.9, whatever that loss ratio turns out to be. The 20 new business policies are generated from the same uniform distribution, and again, they're initially reduced for the renewal rate change, because I want to put them initially at the same rate level as the renewal book. But then what I do is I hit them with the new business differential. So what I do is I assume if my new business differential is 10%, they get a premium that's an additional 10% lower. I've already given them the renewal rate change, and now I'm going to give them the new business differential. So now they're basically 20% below the rate level for the renewal book. Okay, so previous results assume that the base book of business carries 60, and after loss business, the renewal book is unchanged. So again, this is an assumption that I want to talk about. Is the renewal book really unchanged? The reality is that there may be a bias in the loss business, and in the soft market, we might expect the better business to be leaving. Now, this is really not clear. This is something that we've talked about. We say that we hear that business is being lost for large rate increases. So maybe they're getting these large rate increases because this is the better quality business and the competitors are coming in and they're kind of trying to skim the cream. They're trying to take the better business and they're willing to give them 20 to 30% rate decreases or whatever. The other side of the story, which we sometimes hear from our clients, is yes, we are dropping our rates by 10%, but we're keeping the better business and we're letting the lousy business go. Which one do you believe? Okay, so I tried the next step, and this is really the reason why I used the simulation model. I didn't really need a simulation model to do the new business effect. I took the more conservative interpretation of the lost business, at least for a starting point, and I said that the expected retention, that better business is in fact going to go away. And I took a shot at trying to quantify that. So what I said is that the renewal retention becomes a function of the loss ratio, of the inherent loss ratio of the business. So the lower the loss ratio is, the less chance you have of retaining the business. And the worse the loss ratio is, you're going to be stuck with it, pretty much. And I have no idea how to quantify this. So I started out by taking sort of a one-for-one. I said for each point of loss ratio variation, I get initial renewal retention. So if the loss ratio, if the book is 60, if this particular policy has an expected loss ratio of 62, my renewal retention, my probability of renewing that is going to be 82 instead of 80. Now, you could have done it proportionally. You could have done it a lot of different ways. I just tried doing it this way. Of course, I ran into the problem that some of them had over 100% of probability of retention. I had to adjust for that. But it was kind of a directional thing. I wanted to see what effect this would have. Now, I probably had the wrong order of these slides, but this is sort of the result of, well, no, actually it isn't. This is for the 80% renewal retention rate. If you look at the lower line, which is the base case, that's assuming that that's not having a variable. That's assuming a constant retention and all of renewal business has the same loss ratio. You can see that at a new business differential of zero, in other words, if you assume that the new business is at the same rate level as renewal business, your loss ratio projects to about 83. And now, if you go to a minus 10 differential, which is not really that large a differential in this market, the loss ratio now has jumped to about 87. Now, if you're pricing a reinsurance treaty, that's a really big effect. That's a big difference in how you would view the profitability of that treaty. And of course, if you go to minus 20, as you'd expect, it pretty much goes up by about the same amount. It goes to about a 92 loss ratio. So think about this now. You've decided that the new business is 20% weaker priced than renewal business, and the rest of your assumptions are perfectly reasonable, and your loss ratio projection, instead of being 83, is now 92. Now, the second case, where you vary the retention based on the quality of the business, based on the assumption that I described before, you get a similar effect, except that even with with zero new business differential, you get an effect because of the loss business. So this is sort of the loss business effect. You get a deterioration of your loss ratio, even if you assume new business is coming in at the same rate, because your book of business is deteriorating just because you're losing better business. Moshe.
Based on that argument, though, wouldn't the new business be better now because someone else's better business is leaving? So you have to say you count your losing your better business, but you're also gaining someone else's better business.
Maybe. Yes, it's possible. Yes?
Your assumption that the worst business would be more likely to retain that, right?
Yes.
At what point does that start to fail? At what point does underwriting come in and they say, here's some truly bad business, we're going to get rid of it?
Yep.
It's a very high loss ratio. So I would maintain that this relationship only applies
right.
A little
yep.
bit, but to the truly high loss ratio stuff, I think they might get rid of it. There might be some effect in this.
Yeah, I don't think it's a black and white thing. I think there's a little bit of both. Also, the other thing that I haven't mentioned is, how and this again might depend on how you view the underwriting ability of your seeding company. How good are they at determining which is the good business and a not so good business, particularly when there are small differentials? I mean, if you look at any risk, particularly if you're talking about umbrella business, let's say. Any risk can have a loss and still be a good piece of business. So you have to sort of evaluate the underwriting shop that you're dealing with to determine how well. But you're absolutely right. It may be that particularly in the extremes where you have an extremely bad piece of business, that they're just not going to retain it. And if you have an extremely good piece of business, they may it may be that they actually retain it. So this is a speculative kind of calculation. And the second thing, we don't really do this yet. We're just starting to think about it. We do the first thing. We do the new business differential because I feel like the new business differential is something that can be objectively measured, at least to some extent. I think with perfect information, you can measure it. The other thing, the quality of the business, that's very hard to objectively measure. What is a good piece of business? A good piece of business is a business that doesn't have is a risk that doesn't have losses. But any risk can be lucky and just not have losses for a few years, and a good risk can have bad luck and have a loss. So that becomes very subjective. And I would suggest that even after the fact, you might not know for a long time whether you've really made the right decision on this. But if you have a long history with your client, you may be able to figure this out. But if this really were the case, now you're in a worst possible case of a 96 loss ratio where you started at an 83. And admittedly, I think that might be a little bit extreme. But I'm just doing this to kind of illustrate how material these issues really are. And I think it is pretty dramatic. And okay, I tried one more run at it using 60%. Obviously, this is going to magnify everything because if you're retaining less business, obviously you're losing more business. And I think I've also assumed here the same premium volume, which is really probably not a good comparison. So it's really throwing more. No, actually I haven't. I've kept the 20 new policies is kept constant. So I'm not assuming any more new business. I'm just assuming that they're losing more business. And you can see now we've gotten ourselves into over 100%. But this is probably, and by the way, a 60% retention rate is not unheard of. If you're dealing with an E&S writer in this market, that can happen very easily. Okay, so I've convinced all of you that this is important, but now you say, have I? Now, well, how do I do this? How do I estimate this variable that you've now defined, this new business differential variable? I think Larry touched on this a little bit in his talk. The first thing is ask the company, hey, have you thought about new business? And you'd be surprised. A lot of primary companies out there are thinking about this. They maybe don't have the real answer to it, but they're doing some work. They're trying to analyze their book, and they're looking at this. And many times you get the answer that, well, we really don't expect our new book to be any different than our renewal book because we're using the same pricing model. We're using the same ILFs, we're using the same rating factors, we have the same underwriters, but we all know that when there are pressures to grow or pressures to not shrink, in order to get a piece of new business, you may have to do things that you don't have to do on a renewal piece of business. Now, we have heard opposite arguments too. I should point that out. One argument we've heard is that, well, on a piece of new business, we don't know it as well, so we're not likely to be competitive on the rate. We're going to want to get our rate because we have uncertainty on a renewal. And a piece of business we've been writing for 20 years, we may really be able to give them a 10 or 20% discount because we know them very well and we're comfortable with them. That's an argument in the other direction.
Yeah, Gerson? Far frequently heard the other argument, which is, let's bring them to the door and then fix it. So.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I agree.
We're not sort of the worst business. I would argue